President Sadat?
The office of President Sadat.
How are you this morning? President Sadat, I wanted to call you and congratulate you on the great role that you played in the negotiations that have culminated in this agreement. Unfortunately, I don't hear you too well, Mr. President. I hope that my conversation is coming through more clearly. Let me express most emphatically on behalf of my government the appreciation for your statesmanship despite adversity and some criticism, the spirit with which you have approached the need for an agreement. I am most grateful for the leadership that you've given, and I look forward to continuing to work with you in...
Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me, Mr. President?
Yes, I can hear you very
well. Well, I know that you and I recognize that stagnation and stalemate in the Middle East would have been potentially disastrous, and your leadership in working with Secretary Kissinger and with the Israelis, all of us are most grateful for. And as we continue to work together personally as well as government to government.
Hello?
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 Yes, I can hear you, Mr. President. I hope you can hear me, Mr. President. Yes. I don't hear too well, Mr. President. Hello? Yes, this is President Ford. The connection, unfortunately, is not too good for me to hear your comments, Mr. President. Let me say, if I might, despite the difficulties, that Mrs. Ford and I hope that Mrs. Sadat and you and your children will visit the United States sometime this fall. Secretary Kissinger has told me of the very warm hospitality that you've extended to him and Mrs. Kissinger, and we look forward to reciprocating when you come to the United States in the fall of 1975. This will be... I regret that I can't hear. The connection is very bad. I hope that you can hear me and my comments from the United States.
There's a little more on the tape, but I think it's sheer decency to get him off the hook.
You get the idea, yeah?
Yeah.
It's pretty excruciating. But, you know, that happens a lot in the presidency. That's a back-scratching call. And with
oh, yeah, obviously.
Talking points.
Probably scripted, yeah. Talking points in front of him, which somebody has worked out for. And he's going to get through it, whether Sadat is on the phone or not, or whether Sadat could hear him or not. You think that... that very faint voice we hear from Cairo or from Alexandria is not Sadat.
Well, that's actually, Milt, the funniest part of this tape, unintentionally. I listened to it a number of times, and then I was shocked to realize that the voice very much at the beginning is, he says, Office of President Sadat. He doesn't say President Sadat.
Uh-huh.
It's a butler or an assistant who's holding the phone until President Sadat finishes whatever he's doing and gets to the phone.
And it takes him a while to realize that he's talking to President Ford.
Exactly. And this goes on and on.
You hear him say very faintly, is this President Ford?
Yes. And he says, just one moment, please,
yes.
for President Sadat. But Ford can't hear that, and he stumbles through this whole speech. And late in the call, a very bad connection, Sadat finally comes on, and it's just too painful to listen to the whole call. But Gerry Ford, it shows you him in action, a profoundly decent man
yeah.
who never dreamed of being president. This thought rarely occurred to him, if ever. And when you look at the record and you talk to the people who worked for him and you try to get past the painful public presentation, he was a decent man who, and Henry Kissinger told me that he thought that Ford saved the country, and he's never been given credit for it.
Now, you have some material in the new book, Inside the Oval Office, suggesting that Ford was very bothered that the Nixon people thought that he, Ford, had agreed to give the pardon as a condition for Nixon to go ahead and resign.
The Ford pardon is a fascinating subject that I can't, I just think it's beyond my expertise to give a good point of view on. I think that he thought that it would be best for the country and best for the country's efforts and energies to get over the Nixon trial possibility. But it shows you an executive flaw that he had. That's the one decision he took, Milt, alone, without any advice, because he thought it would leak out.
And Dalton said that one decision probably sunk his presidency.
Absolutely. Totally. And he also killed his own presidency when he stubbornly and rather stupidly insisted that he didn't say Poland was a free nation, yeah. But Gerry Ford, for all his limitations, was a profoundly decent man who, in that job, I think did a darn good job of holding the country together. And there's a wonderful story where on day 10 or 11 of his presidency, he is shocked to find out that the microphones of Dick Nixon's taping system are still in the Oval Office in the Ford administration. Now, the wires cut, but the recording equipment is still there and the mics. And he says, damn it, they told me they were taken out of here. And that night, the Secret Service ripped the mics out and painted over the that part of the Oval Office.
There's a president we've missed, but we're going to come back to him after some commercials, and that's Lyndon Baines Johnson. We've still been transferring some of the tape material to cart, as they say in the radio trade, and so only now is it ready. We will pause for the usual reasons and then directly return to William Doyle, drawing from his new book, Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton. That is, by the way, just recently published by Kodansha. Unless you want to say Kodansha.
Or Japanese. You say Kodansha, I'll say Kodansha.
They do some very interesting publishing. And we will be directly back with some tapes representing the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson. First, these words.
This year, give your dad the ultimate Father's Day gift, dinner for two anywhere in the world for free. That's right. Treat dad to seared mahi-mahi in Tahiti, bouillabaisse on the French Riviera, or triple-cut lamb chops in Rio de Janeiro for free. The ultimate Father's Day gift is brought to you by the ultimate specialty food store on the internet, greatfood.com. This sweepstakes is an opportunity for you to discover the ease and convenience of ordering the great specialty foods of the world on the internet at greatfood.com. The Father's Day shop at greatfood.com can deliver live Maine lobsters, tender baby back ribs, or a golf collection of handcrafted chocolates to your home for Father's Day. You can win the ultimate great food adventure, dinner for two, anywhere in the world for free at greatfood.com. Or send a postcard to P.O. Box 4112, Grand Rapids, Minnesota 55730. No purchase necessary. Make Father's Day shopping simple at greatfood.com, the ultimate specialty food store on the internet.
Ah, another great Chicago summer. Outdoor dining, street markets, food and music festivals in the park. So what do you have planned this weekend? Here's an idea. Head to the Chicago Hilton, home all summer long to Fab Fridays, where you can reserve a room for just $99. Imagine, you'll be just steps away from all the Loop and Lakefront have to offer. Walk to Grant Park in Chicago's world-class museum and enjoy all the extras of Michigan Avenue's foremost luxury hotel at a mere fraction of the cost. spacious rooms, an indoor pool and jacuzzi, and even deluxe rooms for families with two double beds and two bathrooms. And on Fab Fridays at the Chicago Hilton, it's all just $99 for the night. Space is limited, so reserve your room today at 800-HILTON and ask for code P6. Again, that's 800-HILTON, code P6. Offer valid Fridays only, additional nights at prevailing rates. Fab Fridays at the Chicago Hilton. This summer, make it a Fab Friday.
Call a friend and make a date to visit the Little Traveler in Geneva. All 36 rooms of this well-known Victorian mansion are decked out for summer. The cornerstone of Geneva's unique shopping district, the Little Traveler.
Ready for a relaxing getaway you won't find anywhere else? How about a place so adored that Midwest Living called it a great weekend getaway? Discover Rockholm Garden Theme Park in Illinois Amish Country, only 3 hours south of Chicago.
I'm Alan Yoder. Rockholm Gardens has been in the Yoder family for over 40 years. We prided ourselves on providing visitors a relaxing, memorable day at our 15-acre park. Discover a different world with horse, train, and buggy rides, rock and flower gardens, antique museum, Amish home, petting farm, and much more. Our shops are full of Amish crafted furniture, quilts, cheese, and crafts. Rockholm's family-style restaurant serves a delicious all-you-can-eat Thrasherman's dinner. Saturday, see our classic auto show, and Sunday, hear brass classics. Hope to see you.
Experience Rockholm Garden Theme Park in Illinois Amish Country, only 3 hours south of Chicago in Arcola. For free information, access the web at www.rockome.com or call 800-549-ROCK. That's 800-549-ROCK.
The Radio 720 Grand Slam Game. It means $720 cash. Every day the Cubs play, you've got a chance to win a new truck. But you can't win if we don't have your name, age, address, and phone number. Mail those stats to Cubs Grand Slam Game, 435 North Michigan Avenue, Chicago, 60611.
There's an entry form in the Daily Herald every Tuesday.
Then turn up the Cubs to win.
From Ed DeBenick.
Jimmy Lou.
Cellular One.
Old Style.
The Daily Herald.
The Wickstrom Dealer.
And
Radio 720 WGN. There isn't anything Don McHugh Chevrolet won't do for you.
Oh, yeah? Do they offer a great selection?
Great selection is an understatement. Don McHugh Chevrolet has over 800 new cars, trucks, conversion vans, and pre-driven certified vehicles. You name it, Don McHugh Chevrolet has it.
What about financing?
They'll finance everyone with 100% of applications accepted. How does 0% APR financing strike you?
Will they still give me a rebate?
Rebates? How about rebates of $2,000 on Cavalier and Lumina, $1,500 on Malibus, $2,000 on Blazers, and $2,500 on any conversion van. There isn't anything Don McHugh Chevrolet won't do for you.
Okay, okay, I get the picture. How do I get to Don McHugh Chevrolet?
That's easy. Look for them on Route 64. That's North Avenue in beautiful St. Charles. Or call 630-584-9700. 630-584-9700 and ask, is there anything, I mean anything, Don McHugh Chevrolet won't do for you? See the WGN Fan Van this Friday from noon to 2 at the Crystal Lake AAA Chicago Motor Club Travel Store, 6234 Northwest Highway. Stop by and get your WGN Radio Cubs ID, courtesy of Elmhurst Camera, your picture place.
The tents are up. The prices are down at the Great Mercury Tent Event going on right now at your Mercury dealer. Save big on a rugged 99 Mercury Mountaineer, the premium sport utility without the premium price. Because during the Great Mercury Tent Event, you can get low APR financing for a limited term on Mountaineer and save thousands of dollars in financing costs. Mountaineer comes with your choice of a powerful V6 or V8, the added traction of available all-wheel drive.
Oh, no!
Plus a roomy, luxurious interior that takes all the comforts of home everywhere you go. And right now, there's a big selection on the ground and ready to move. So,
go!
To your Mercury dealer before July 5th, 1999. Save big with low APR financing on a rugged Mercury Mountaineer. And imagine yourself in a Mercury. Because when you can get away from it all, with it all, in a Mercury Mountaineer, it's no time to waste. It's time to...
go!
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. This is Milton Rosenberg.
And back to William Doyle. We are drawing from his new book, Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton, and we're drawing from a wonderful file of available tapes, though, of course, much more will yet become available. The one we just heard, the Ford thing, am I right? We premiered it here for the first time on American radio?
Well, I believe that was a world premiere event for Milton Rosenberg.
Well, thank you very much.
The Gerald Ford tapes, of that Gerald Ford tape. Yeah,
yeah, that's the particular one.
Yeah.
The next one that's coming up and we're going backwards, we're going back to LBJ, is actually from another collection, though I know you've heard it, and you excerpt some portions of these tapes in your book Inside the Oval Office. But Michael Beschloss did a special book, and they also issued four cassettes of Lyndon Baines Johnson tapes, and he apparently taped an awful lot that went on in the Oval Office and virtually all of his phone conversations.
Yes, almost 10,000 of them, and the beauty of that is that there are a number of years yet to be released, and Lyndon Johnson used the telephone like an assault weapon. He fired off 75 or 100 calls a day.
We are about to hear him doing just that. The situation here is that he's trying to persuade Sergeant Shriver, the brother-in-law of the slain president and of now Attorney General Robert Kennedy, trying to persuade Sergeant Shriver to head the War on Poverty program. Shriver is already the head of the Peace Corps, and he's reluctant. He doesn't want to get in the middle between himself and Bobby Kennedy, or rather between the president and Bobby Kennedy. And in general, he's got other reasons to doubt that this is the best way to expend his career. But Johnson won't take no for an answer. And here we hear the Johnson treatment.
Yes, and as Bill Moyers once said, telling Lyndon Johnson no was like standing at the water's edge and shouting at the tide to go back.
That's the King Lear moment, as a matter of fact. Shall we hear it? This is really a very potent encounter.
As an enticement, he has been hinting that he might choose Shriver for his vice presidential running mate. Still, Shriver knows that the new anti-poverty agency has no staff, no concrete plan, not even a name. It could collapse on his head, and he may be more than slightly nervous about what his brother-in-law, Robert Kennedy, will say about his joining the enemy.
Yes?
Shriver on 9-0.
Marge, good morning, Mr. President. How are you?
I'm going to announce your appointment at press conference.
What press conference?
This afternoon.
Oh, God, I think it would be advisable, if you don't mind, if I could have this weekend. I wanted to sit down with a couple of people and see what we could get in the way of some sort of a plan, because what happens, at least my thought is that what happens is that you announce somebody or hear somebody else, and they don't know what the hell they're doing or what the program's going to be specifically, and who's going to carry it. Then you're in a hell of a hole because they start calling you up and saying, well, now, what are you going to do?
Well,
carry it out and all that, and you don't
Don't talk to them. Just go away and go to Camp David. Figure it out. We need something to say to the press. We've got to say to them, and I've got to tell them what I talked to you about yesterday. And you can just take off, work out your Peace Corps any way you want to. You can be head of the committee and have some acting operator. If you want Bill to help you, I'll let him do that. I'll do anything, but I want to announce this and get it behind me so I quit getting all these other pressures. And I think you've got to do it. You just can't let me down. So the quicker we get it behind us, the better. And generally speaking,
could you just say that you've asked me to study this?
No, hell no. They've studied and studied and studied. They want to know who in the hell's going to do this, and it's leaked all over the papers for 2 weeks that you're going to do it, and they'll be shooting me with questions. They've already done it. And I want to say that you're going to be special assistant president and executive in charge of the poverty program, and how that affects your Peace Corps relationship. You'll still maintain it, but you will be glad to go into that with them at a later date. At the present, you're working up the organization for this. What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem with it is that, knock the crap out of the Peace Corps.
Not if they tell them that you're not severing your identification with the Peace Corps.
Well, of course, you've got the sense of the situation. I must say that I would prefer, Mr. President, if I had a 48 hours even to work with our staff around the world, so that they won't hear this over the worldwide Voice of America or something like that. They might.
It's not going to be anything but a compliment to you. They're going to be proud of you. They're going to be applauding you. I'm not taking you away from that. I'm just giving you $1 billion more to work with. And if you can't run a $100 million program in your left hand and a $1 billion with your right hand, you're not as smart as I think you are.
Besides, the money's got, that's no problem at all. It's the people that I'm in.
Well, the people,
I want to keep all these people for the government, that are in the Peace Corps and bring them into any other program so that they...
Well, that's good. I'm not going to sever you from the Peace Corps at all. I'm going to say that you're going to maintain your identification with the Peace Corps. And I'm going to make that clear. But I am going to make it clear that you're Mr. Poverty. And at home and abroad, you ought to be. And I don't care who you have run the Peace Corps. If you can run it, wonderful. If you can't, get Oshkosh from Chicago, and I'll name it.
I can't get anybody. The only guy that could possibly do it, Mr. President, is Bill.
Well, you can write your ticket. You can write your ticket on anything you want to do there. I want to get rid of poverty, though.
Yeah.
And the Sunday paper is going to say it's you, Mr. Poverty, unless you've got real compelling reasons, which I hadn't heard. And I'm going to say that you're going to maintain your identification with the Peace Corps and operate it to such an extent as you may think desirable.
This will be a bombshell.
Not if you... Hell, it'll be a promotion. You've got your identification with the Peace Corps. You got everything you ever had there, plus this. I don't know what why they would object to that. Unless you got some women that think you won't have enough time to spend with them.
Well,
you got the responsibility. You got the authority. You got the power. You got the money. Now, you may not have the glands.
The glands?
Yeah.
I got plenty of glands.
All right. Well, I have them. I have them. That's one of my... I'd like to have your glands, then.
Yeah.
Yeah, but all you got to do is... I need Dr. Brinkley myself.
Yeah.
And those goat glands.
Yeah. Well, you feel that you got to do it this afternoon?
I think I ought to.
About a... And we will pause there. That's just an incredible confrontation.
Incredible, yes.
It has many levels also.
As Dick Russell said, that man will twist your arm off and bash your head in with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a wonderful performance artist, and he's a bulldozer, and he's a repulsive creature all at the same time. I mean, what you don't hear on that tape is what one of the Kennedy men who later worked for Johnson told me, and he didn't want his name used. Mm-hmm. I think he was still afraid of a dead Johnson some decades later. They're still afraid of him, some of them. But he said to me, quote, and this is not a universal conclusion by any means, but he said that LBJ, quote, LBJ was an emasculator, an egocentric son of a bitch. I think he was a rat, pure and simple. There was a real screw loose there. He was vindictive. He was kooky. He enjoyed administering pain to people. He loved it. And I thought, that was the day-to-day work atmosphere of this man to many people, and I wouldn't want to work for him.
Did you get that reference at the end to Brinkley's goat glands?
What is Brinkley's goat glands?
I can explain something to the author. Well, of course, the dialogue with the two of them just before that, when he says, you can do it if you got the glands. Now, first he makes mention of, well, I don't want to take you away from your other women, if that's what's worrying you.
Okay.
And then he mentions the glands. The reference there is to sexuality, obviously. And so it's kind of an imputation about the Kennedy style, and maybe he knows something that we don't know, and that doesn't even concern us now. But then, of course, Shriver responds, well, I've got the glands, all right. And then the president says, well, I don't. I have to depend. I better get to Dr. Brinkley. Dr. Brinkley was a healer type, really a charlatan type, who was kicked out of the country and ran a great radio station just across the border in Mexico, in which he advertised Brinkley's goat glands, which were supposed to be a restorative for male sexuality.
The original Viagra. Is that
the original Viagra, and it goes back to the 1930s on through the 1960s, apparently.
Well, did it work?
I have no idea. But that's what the reference is in that bit of the dialogue.
I see. Well, by the way, was that the voice of famed presidential historian Michael Beschloss? I heard, I think, at the beginning.
At the beginning, yes. That's from the tapes.
I see. Well, I just, not usually in the business of plugging other people's books, but he wrote a wonderful book that I think is still in print called The Crisis Years, which was not about Johnson, but about Kennedy and Khrushchev. And that's an extraordinary book because that goes really into the day-to-day rhythm of that relationship.
Well, I would say that with this book inside the Oval Office, you, William Doyle, have entered the precincts of significant presidential historians. It's a small group, Robert Caro, Michael Beschloss, and Bob Woodward, of course, who, by the way, will be with us on Monday night, and his new book deals with all of the presidents that you're dealing with here.
Well, thank you. That's a pretty elite squad, Milt. The fun thing about doing this book was to spend time with all the people who worked for these men and to try to figure out what it was like to walk into the office and get into action with these presidents as executives. The big point of my book, Milt, is that the tapes show us not only the flesh and blood humanity of the presidents, but it shows us their executive skills, and that's the part that our lives depend on. Because, in my opinion, we don't have ideological presidents in the modern presidency, and there are no ideological presidents. I include Ronald Reagan, because he checked his ideology at the door, and he was a very pragmatic, very flexible man, and he abandoned many conservative causes once he entered the Oval Office, I think. And
in my judgment, he used the presidency more effectively than anybody. Probably since Roosevelt. He was a persuader.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to kind of motivate people and to satisfy them, and he didn't lose his cool, and he didn't become overwhelmed or obsessed or disordered by the power of the presidency, a power which could not always be effectively used. I will never forget a wonderful anecdote about Truman, who also certainly had his cool and his wits about him. Truman sitting in the Oval Office the day of the inauguration of Eisenhower, and he's having a last bourbon and water with some friends of his before they start the trip to the Capitol for the inauguration. And he says, Ike is going to sit here, meaning at this desk, and he's going to say, do this, do that, and then he's not going to understand why nothing happens.
Yeah, I looked at Eisenhower originally and thought that he was a dunce, a befuddled man, a befuddled mm-hmm. grandfather, and I started talking to the people who worked for him. I started reading the right books on him, and I went out to the Eisenhower Library and got into the first tapes that were found on Eisenhower, and I came out the other end, of course, with the proper conclusion, which is he was the best overall, underline overall, chief executive, in my opinion, of the whole modern era, because he ran that, he ran it beautifully as a board of directors style operation with 8 years of peace and prosperity. Now, he failed to confront McCarthy, and he failed to confront civil rights, to all of our, I think, great shame. But he was, in many ways, a great president. But Reagan, I was surprised to learn that the Chicago Sun-Times, a balanced poll of historians mm-hmm. in 96, put him, Reagan, in the top third of the presidents. And I thought, well, why on earth is that? And so I made a pilgrimage to the Reagan Library and camped out there for weeks at a time, and I found these wonderful videos. The archivist showed me these wonderful videos of Reagan in action in some closed presidential meetings. No press, no public. And the Reagan I saw, at least in the first few years of his presidency, mm-hmm. was superb. He conquered congressmen just as well as Johnson did. His congressional box scores were just as strong. And let's face it, no matter what anybody thinks of Ronald Reagan, that man stepped into that office, stepped up to the controls of the nuclear arms race, and he shut it down. He reversed the nuclear arms race. He stopped it and reversed it, and he had a lot of help, but that's a tremendous achievement, I believe, that we all should be thankful for.
Well, it seems to me the difference between effective and presidents and presidents who ultimately fail is whether they have the vanity that requires constant obedience and constant glorification. The competent presidents we've talked about didn't seem to have that. They had a kind of inner assurance of their own worth. FDR surely had that. Apparently Eisenhower had that. Apparently Reagan had it as well. And Truman certainly did.
Yes, they were already great men. I don't think they sought to achieve it.
Well, the Congress didn't count Truman as a great man. There was no great accomplishment before the death of Roosevelt, which propelled him to the presidency.
Very good point. I guess he did find it in the Oval Office. You're right.
Yeah.
Although I'm not sure I think on that last day of the in the Oval Office, he might have felt pretty bad because of what was going on in Korea and mm-hmm. how hated a man he was. A president who intrigues me, well, they all do, but Reagan, I think we have some tape on, and it's really, these are congressional sessions. He's trying to get congressmen to do his bidding. And mm-hmm. What you hear is a very in-charge chief executive who's working from little note card cheat sheets very effectively. You can hardly see him do it. And the congressmen are riveted, spellbound. They're melting in the chairs in the Oval Office and the cabinet room. You can
yeah.
see it.
We settle for caricatures very often in the popular history, the popular understanding of presidents. The caricature of Ronald Reagan is, well, he took naps. He was never really there. That's not true. That in the end, of course, he came to the difficulty of Alzheimer's disease is sad, and it's a fact of life. Mm-hmm. But laid back though he may have been, and low energy though he seemed to have been, in fact he was, I think, a quite effective administrator.
Absolutely. Now, he had flaws, and they almost killed his presidency. But in his time, Ronald Reagan tolerated and encouraged debate, big debate, fierce debate among his own men, which is a superb skill to have in the Oval Office.
We are overdue for a commercial this time to catch up with those. Also, we will be working in some telephone calls, and we will open the phone lines right now. The number, as usual, 591-7200, 591-7200, and, of course, the area code is 312 if you're calling long distance, and double, of course, if you are far away listening to us on the Internet and would rather communicate via email. The email line is open, and the email address is simply extension720@tribune.com. Extension 720, one word, as they say, @tribune.com. By either mode of communication, we're looking forward to your contributions. Get them in quickly, please, and we will return directly after these words.
Get what you need in the morning.
A city council committee,
get college,
flatly rejected a proposal by a West Side alderman that would have eased a crackdown on motorists who cruise Chicago streets in cars with bass-pounding, ear-splitting stereos. You've had them pull up next to you.
Boom, 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 boom.
Alderman Percy Giles contended that the three-year-old measure that imposed stiff fines had fallen disproportionately on minorities. Alderman, with all due respect, get in the game here. The issue is the noise, not the race.
The Bob Collins Show.
Every time you turn around, something is either a liberal plot, a conservative plot, or a racist plot.
Weekday mornings at 5.
Now, I'm not overreacting.
Radio 720.
Oh, no, not me.
WGN.
It's Majestic Star Casino's three-year anniversary, and we're giving away the world. In honor of our anniversary, we've decided to give away the vacation of a lifetime. On June 30th, one of our Lucky Club Majestic members will win an all-expense-paid trip for four around the world. Fiji, Italy, France, and Singapore are just a few of the magnificent destinations featured on this trip. First-class accommodations, airfare, tours, and meals are all included to make this a dream vacation you'll never forget. And the winning doesn't stop there. We're giving away even more trips during the month of June, and we're sure you'll want to come in each week for your chance to win. On June 9th, you could win a trip for two to London, England. Paris, France awaits you on our June 16th drawing. On June 23rd, a trip to Sydney, Australia will be given away. And of course, on June 30th, Majestic Star Casino will give away the world. So hurry into Majestic Star Casino to win an entry. After all, it's not every day someone gives you the world. See casino for complete details.
See the Wickstroms now for big savings on more than 1,000 new and used cars and trucks, plus rebates up to $2,000 and 0% financing on selected models. Hurry and save at Wickstrom Ford in Barrington, Wickstrom Chevrolet in Roselle.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host and moderator, Milt Rosenberg.
And we return to William Doyle, whose new book, Inside the Oval Office, just published by Kodan Shaw, and available wherever they sell real books. Since we were just talking about Reagan, let's have a touch of Ronald Reagan, of the Gipper, in the night. In the intro, this one, this is where he's talking to the cabinet about the Grenada invasion.
That's right. This is October 25th, 1983, and it's an incredible moment for Reagan because think of what's happened to him in the last 48 hours. First of all, a terrorist has blown up the Marine barracks in Beirut. 241 Marines were killed. Reagan said it was the saddest day of his life, and you could understand that. That same day, 2 million Europeans march into the streets against his nuclear arms policies. And this, also in this period, Grenada is invaded, and Ronald Reagan launches a, Grenada falls into chaos, and Ronald Reagan launches an invasion. During this tape, Ronald Reagan is in a closed meeting, no press, no public. The only people in the room are his cabinet and a video crew in a corner openly shooting videotape of this real meeting. And Reagan is explaining to his cabinet what's happening. Combat and firing is going on, and he tells them why he made this historic decision. So that's what's happening.
Here it is.
At 5:15 this morning, the joint force landed at two spots on Grenada. Paratroopers in the south, Marines and other multiple force in the north, secured both airports. They're 8 miles apart, the one at the south tip of the island, and then the operational one, the one with the Cuban, the buildings up further north. Both airports are under our control. We have secured the school for the safety of the people. There is now firing and combat going on. There have been casualties. They've been evacuated to the USS Guam. We're going to see if we've got any update on reports here in a minute when they let us talk to you. But it was our feeling in making this decision, and believe me, it wasn't easy, and certainly in the face of what had happened in Lebanon, to order a thing of this kind. But first of all, was our consideration for our own people. And second was, once this urgent plea had come to us, none of us believed that there was any way that the United States could say no to that without, in the eyes of the world, revealing that when the chips were down, we backed away. And I don't know what credibility we would have in the Middle East or anyplace else if we had done that. We believe we've taken the right action. We hope we'll be shortly out of there.
Of course, the basic argument he's using to justify the invasion of Grenada is the credibility argument. To maintain our credibility around the world, where we face a lot of other trouble, we've got to show that we're capable of action.
Just like Johnson did in some of his Vietnam tapes, where he says it would lose face in the world if we don't go in, which is a bizarre argument when you think of what happened.
And we paid a much larger cost. That was the Vietnam War. Here is the invasion of Grenada. Did we lose any men at all in that?
We lost, I believe, under 100, but there were fatalities.
There
it might have been on a scale of 20 or 30.
Yeah.
But the extraordinary thing about Reagan, in my mind, is his failings are that he was too nice a guy. He hated to fire people, and as a result, there was great staff chaos there, and he was incapable. He abdicated. He abdicated 80% of his presidency very openly and clearly, and he hoped the rest would be run properly, and it didn't always happen.
We're kind of working our way backward and forward with a little bit of a disruption of the chronological order. What do you have on George Bush? We don't have any Bush recordings with us. Is there much available?
George Bush ran a White House in which one of Bush's men told me anybody who taped would have been shot.
Uh-huh.
I believe that. There is...
That's why it's the shortest chapter in your book, I think.
It's a short chapter, and I like to think it's a good chapter, though, Milt.
I'm sure it is.
But it's built really on interviews with Bush's people.
Yeah.
Because this, remember, this my book is really also about executive style, and I'd say that two-thirds of the book isn't tape transcripts, but it's interviews and narrative and historical action. But in the case of Bush, I found, of course, that he was a tremendous, tremendous diplomatic engineer, and I don't think you could find a better man in the world to run America's role in the collapse of the post-Cold War order. But the trouble was that you and I couldn't see him doing that, and thanks to him, we can never hear or see him doing it in any tape form either, and that's a bit of a tragedy, I think, for him.
I've got to discuss with you the man who succeeded George Bush, with whom we are still rather familiar, perhaps too familiar by now. I've also got to take care of some commercials because we're running quite late on those. And so we're going to pause right now for some commercials. We will shortly also be getting onto the phones. The number 591-7200, 591-7200. And we return right after these words.
Save up to 80% by buying Factory Direct. The Jewelry Exchange is a direct diamond importer with 10 modern factories nationwide. Currently, there are shortages of certain diamonds, but the Jewelry Exchange is such a high-volume dealer that our cutters in Tel Aviv save most of these diamonds for us. The Jewelry Exchange has hundreds of D through H, VVS to SI quality 1-carat and 2-carat diamonds, diamonds most jewelers can't find. Most of our diamonds have GIA or EGL certs, and all are guaranteed lowest price. Because of the recession in the Far East, diamonds we import from India have dropped over 30%. 2-carat tennis bracelets that were $6.99 are now just $3.29. 1-carat earrings, $3.99. 1-carat hearts are just $1.99. Only the Jewelry Exchange guarantees all their finished jewelry up to $3,000 to appraise for at least double. Some restrictions apply. Don't miss these deals. Buy Factory Direct and save. The Jewelry Exchange in Elmhurst, 630-530-9490. The Jewelry Exchange in Elmhurst, 630-530-9490.
Ready to be served a gourmet meal in a lovely dining room? Maybe drinks with friends in the pub or a friendly game of billiards? Ready to give up on the responsibility of home ownership? Then consider The Seasons at Glenview Place. The Seasons is a new independent and assisted living retirement community. Their one- and two-bedroom apartments have full kitchens, individually controlled heating and air conditioning, neutral wall-to-wall carpeting, and mini blinds. You decorate your apartment just as you please. There's no endowment nor large entrance fee, so you can control your own assets. Your monthly fee includes your choice of lunch or dinner each day, transportation to shopping, access to their wellness clinic and fitness center, and much more. Choices are what they are all about. At the Seasons, you have the freedom to choose what you want to do. You're close to the train, major roads, and the villages of Glenview and Northbrook. There's so much more they'd like to tell you about at the Seasons. Call 847-729-5159. 847-729-5159. Discover a whole new world of retirement at the Seasons at Glenview Place.
Get in on the magic.
This magic moment. So different and so new, the Blue Chip Casino. That's a moment for you, this magic moment.
It lights up the Michigan City sky like a dazzling diamond, and it's captivated over a million people with its spell. It's the spectacular Blue Chip Casino, where every moment is magic. Get in on the incredible fun around every corner and let the excitement sweep you away. Blue Chip Casino in Michigan City, Indiana.
This magic moment.
Blue Chip Casino.
Any night and any day you feel it inside you.
Blue Chip Casino.
The magic's gonna carry you away.
Call toll-free 1-888-879-7711.
From Radio 720 WGN, this is Extension 720. Here's your host, Milt Rosenberg.
And we will be going shortly to the telephones. Again, though all the lines were taken, I see now one or two are cleared. The number, 591-7200. Get your calls in quickly if you want to be heard. We'll be with you shortly. 591-7200. We could talk for many programs on the material that we find in your book and sharing our memories and our own interpretations of the history of the modern American presidency. But we come to one of the greatest mysteries of all, the presidency of William Jefferson Clinton. What do you make of it?
I will give you two radically conflicting points of view that I can, that I have to hold simultaneously in order to be honest about him. Number one is he is a fully bogus and invalid president because of what he's done to the office, because of the dagger blow of impeachment, and because if I'm to take allegations like Ms. Broderick's with any remote degree of credibility, and I haven't seen compelling evidence against those allegations yet, yes, they're old, yes, they're painful, but if that's true, then it's even more bogus than it already is.
Then a person who had committed criminal acts was elected to the presidency.
Yes, and that's just too shocking for any of us to dwell on, so where I wind up is the other reality, which is that William Jefferson Clinton has been a very effective and chaotic, he has mastered chaos, political chief executive, because he has been elected twice by all of us, knowing by majorities of us knowing his flaws, and he has presided over, in the wake of a lot of messy sloppiness and chaos and low-level and high-level scandals, balanced budget, strong job growth, booming economy and stock market, had a successful re-election, trade bills, crime bills, budget bills. He has hammered that through because he's an extraordinarily skilled political executive. I think he must be given credit for that at the same moment we absorb the horror of what he's done to the Oval Office.
You brought along a tape. It's only a very small fragment. We'll play it right now, which does have Bill Clinton doing something which in itself may have been illegal. You want to explain that?
Yes, and this tape was the result, it was partly triggered by a rather major research failure of mine. I suspected that these tapes existed of the coffee events, that White House television that followed Reagan around kept following Clinton around.
And those
around.
Coffee events were fundraising in the White House.
Fundraising in the White House, that's right. Now, federal law is a little fuzzy. What you'll hear him saying here in May 96 was alleged by Senator Thompson to be a president leading a conspiracy to evade the campaign finance laws by proudly exploiting the soft money restriction. In other words, channeling money from his specific re-election to soft money issues campaign ads for the Democrats.
This fragment is from a tape before all the big troubles hit the fan.
That's exactly right. This is before the election, and the way this tape got released was the Washington Post. I told the Washington Post man named George Lardner about it. He told the Senate committee about it. They had already asked for such tapes. They pressed the White House specifically about White House television, and lo and behold, these tapes popped out in October 97.
Then you were instrumental in the freeing up and the distribution of those White House coffee tapes.
Well, my original research failure helped trigger the ultimate identification of the coffee tapes, yes.
Here's that little fragment.
The fact that we've been able to finance this long-running, constant television campaign where we were always able to frame the issues, most of it's been actually quite positive, you know, not sort of a big negative hit on the Republicans, but just trying to show the differences in what we're trying to achieve, has been central to the position that I now enjoy in the polls.
Well, a little touch of Bill in the night. It's been a long night for him, I would say. When Nixon resigned, I carried away with it a kind of empathic sense of the tragedy. I would keep asking myself, what would it be like for the rest of his life to wake up in the morning, rub the sleep out of his eyes, and then say, my God, I'm the first man who ever had to resign the American presidency.
Hmm.
Well, what would it be like for Bill Clinton after the presidency as he thinks back to it?
Probably infinitely worse, I would think. For that matter, Milt, how do you go to sleep at night when you're president? Let's say it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you've had an average day or a crisis day.
Mm.
How in the name of goodness do you go to sleep? It's a mystery to me. It's a mystery as to how any of them make it out of that office alive. What I plead for voters to do in the future is I think we always ask the wrong question. I think starting today, we have got to ask George W. Bush, Al Gore, Elizabeth Dole, Bill Bradley the following question. And if they don't answer it properly, they shouldn't be elected by us. And that is specifically, once you're sworn in, what will be your executive approach to the presidency? How will you organize and run it? What are your executive weaknesses? And if you don't know what they are, you don't deserve our vote. Mm-hmm. Find out what they are, talk to your staff, and come to us with some insight on that, because that's the part that our lives depend on. It's the life and death crises when they're running that office, information, debate, budgets, and so forth. And the funny thing is that many of them are never executives before they step into that door. John Kennedy never managed anything but a PT vote in his life before he did.
Franklin Delano Roosevelt did manage the Navy Department, I guess.
Yes.
But he never had any successful business experience at all.
That's fascinating. In the 1920s, you know what he was? He was a venture capitalist for most of the 1920s, and he always failed. But he loved the thrill of the game, investing in various bizarre teams.
Time for us to go to the phones. Time is overdue, in fact, but we will work in as many calls as we can on 591-7200, and you are the first. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt. I have a question for the panel on Wives of the Presidents. Apparently, Nancy Reagan, I guess, did play a role in President Reagan's performance in the White House, particularly in his later years. I was wondering if the panel has any other comments and ideas on any other Wives of the Presidents that played a role in their husband's performance in the White House?
That's a great question. I tried to examine every first lady who had an impact and what was the impact. Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, is well known.
Yes.
Bess Truman, according to Harry, consulted with him on every major decision, and I thought that was pretty extraordinary since she hated Washington and she hated politics. But he relied on her a lot, and I think she's overlooked by history quite a bit. Part of the reason is she burned many of her papers, her letters to him, that is. Mamie Eisenhower played a marginal role. Jackie Kennedy played a marginal role, although certainly a huge public support role. Lady Bird is well known as a major facilitator of Johnson's career and, to some extent, his decision-making. Poor Pat Nixon, had a tough time and was a very tragic lady and a very decent lady who was really overwhelmed by history there. And I think that Nancy Reagan was the chief operating officer of the Reagan years.
That's what the rumors are, right?
Yeah.
Right.
She stepped in constantly on policy and personnel and fired people and made things happen, but in a very one-step-removed kind of way. And she was feared and respected in that White House and a very smart lady. And I think somebody should write a major book on her impact.
Yes.
Well, in fact, somebody did, though he had many scores to settle, namely Donald Reagan, who came out of the White House where he was chief of staff, wasn't he, at that time?
Right.
And blamed her for his being fired and told stories about her consultation with astrologers and so on and so on.
Yes, I spoke to him, and I think he's mellowed a bit since then. But may I ask the caller, which president do you think used his wife's advice the best or relied on his wife in the most interesting way?
I would say Reagan, particularly during his last time period in the White House. I can't think of any, of course, FDR. Well, FDR and his wife had a very strange relationship in the White House, as you recall. Was there any bad will between Jacqueline Kennedy and LBJ when LBJ was vice president under Kennedy's administration?
Excellent question. I'm not qualified on that. I have to speculate because I've not studied that point. I speculate that they had a very remote relationship. It was ceremonial friendliness, and that's about it. I think there was never any real personal closeness between the four of them.
Right. So this happened all during the Kennedy administration. LBJ and Kennedy were never really that close, even though they worked with each other.
Well, Johnson could barely get an appointment with Kennedy in the second half of the Kennedy administration. He was a lonely figure who would sit outside the Oval Office, and they'd wonder, what the heck is he doing here? It was a pretty pathetic relationship.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
Glad to have heard from you. Let us go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. Enjoying the show. About a year or two, there was a tape released of John F. Kennedy talking to Boss Daley, let's call him, in the 60s. Was that part of a new batch that was released or discovered, and it was played in Chicago because it related to Mayor Daley?
Well, we played it on this program when Michael Beschloss was here. It's one of the tapes that he has released. It's early because those tapes only run up until the 64 Democratic Convention, where Johnson almost decides, as he says in another famous conversation, to go up to Atlantic City and tell them he won't run for president because he's wounded by all the criticism he's been getting in the public press. But in that same batch of tapes, there is one where LBJ from Washington, from the Oval Office, is calling Mayor Daley. And Daley says, this is shortly, within just a month or so after his presidency begins. And Daley is flattering him, and they mutually compliment each other. And then Daley asks a favor, namely that Ed Hanrahan be appointed as a federal attorney
for
Chicago.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about. I'm thinking of another one where President Kennedy is asking Boss Daley to persuade a Chicago congressman to change his vote on a...
Kennedy or Johnson?
President Kennedy...
Oh, I don't know this one.
...is asking Mayor Daley to pressure a Chicago congressman who, as President Kennedy puts it, is taking an extreme liberal position and thus negating his own vote. And Mayor Daley uses some profanity and says that this congressman will vote the way the president wants him to, meaning...
Do you know anything of such a tape?
A fascinating question. I don't know that tape offhand.
Well, where did you hear of such a tape, sir?
Well, like I said, it was broadcast very prominently on the local news stations when it came out, and I was just kind of curious about which batch it was. I happened to have had a conversation with this congressman in his 80s or 90s.
Which congressman is that?
It's Roland Libinati, who was Al Capone's congressman.
Uh-huh. Oh, I believe, caller, I believe I know exactly what you're talking about. The Kennedy Library did make a release, I believe it was, I'm going to guess, in 97 or 98, of a group of tapes of Kennedy with, for example, Governor Brown in California. And there were other phone calls in this release. To answer your question, the Kennedy Library and the Johnson Library make periodic releases of this material on a fairly irregular schedule that's dictated by declassification, workload, et cetera. My point is, all these tapes belong to all of us. They don't belong to those presidents. And that's the fascinating thing. They thought it was their personal property, and now we're listening to it through an accident of history.
Well, we thank you for the call. I must be cruel to be kind because we have other people waiting, and we also have a last round of commercials waiting. We'll pause for those. And at the moment, if you've been trying to reach us and getting the busy signal, we now have a number of lines available, so try again and move quickly. 591-7200.
George Reedy.
It used to be tough to exercise, lose weight, shape up, and feel healthy. Now it's easy to do it all right at home, thanks to Fitness Warehouse. You get smart fitness advice. And right now, savings on the greatest selection of treadmills, home gyms, and exercise bikes. Plus, 12 months, no payments, and no interest on any purchase, $5.99 and over. Exercise, shape up, feel healthy, start now. Visit Fitness Warehouse today. Call 1-800-HOME-FIT for the store near you.
It really is easier than ever to shape up and lose weight right at home. And with that treadmill, home gym, and exercise bike just a few steps away, ready when you are. Yes, Fitness Warehouse makes working out so much easier and convenient. And now, with value store-wide and 12 months no payment or interest on any purchase over $5.99, this is the time to visit the Fitness Warehouse store near you. Just call 1-800-HOME-FIT. That's 1-800-HOME-FIT for the Fitness Warehouse store near you.
Hello there, golfing person.
Hey,
hi.
How you doing?
I noticed you pulling up in that Taurus. Let me just put your clubs into the more spacious trunk of this Buick Century.
Isn't the caddy supposed to pick us up in a golf cart?
Personal choice. I prefer the Century.
You're not our caddy. You're an announcer.
Thank you for noticing. Hey, guys, let's take this Century for a test drive. Plenty of room for a foursome, plus two.
That's more room than your Taurus, Bob.
Promote that, man. Bob, take a memo. This Century is a Consumer's Digest Best Buy.
Hey, you can't drive on the golf course.
Well, not in a Taurus LX, but in a Century with standard traction control and standard ABS.
We're not going to get in 18.
You might even get in 30, Bob, with Century's quick keyless entry.
Ooh.
Folks, see for yourself why Century is a luxury car for everyone. $1,500 cash back, it's a great time to visit your nearest dealer and test drive the Century by Buick.
How come a Bob always gets to drive?
Yeah, and you're always fiddling with the radio.
I know this course.
Not right.
Offer applies to all 1999 Buick Centuries. Must take retail delivery from participating dealer stock by 9/30/99. Not available with special GMAC finance or lease offers.
We now return to Extension 720 from WGN Radio Chicago. Now, here's Milton Rosenberg.
And we return to William Doyle. Inside the Oval Office, the fine book that we're drawing from in this conversation tonight, the White House tapes from FDR to Clinton, Kodan Shah is the publishing firm. Our phone number, 591-7200, 591-7200, and another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Doyle.
Hello.
Hi. I wanted to know if you've come across in your research a man that was so intimately involved in President Kennedy's administration, that, of course, his brother Robert, who I think never has really received his just due. Did you form a sense of the man in your research?
I formed a highly conflicted sense of him. Number one, in the Oxford, Mississippi crisis, I saw him jockeying for public relations positioning. I saw him blundering into a very bad crisis with good intentions, and I saw him primarily trying to protect his brother's interests. Now, the image, that's all on tape, but also I have tremendous admiration for the man and how he grew, and the moment he was killed, I think he was moving toward bringing this country together in a profound way, and I think everything would have been different had he lived.
That's
fascinating,
exactly,
man.
What I thought, too, as he matured and grew older.
Is that what you think?
Yes.
Do you think he was potentially great president?
Absolutely. I think he would have either failed miserably or have been a great president, depending upon how he could have gotten Congress behind him.
Well, that's
because he was so impatient.
That's right. He was a very tough guy to deal with, and I wonder if he could have mastered Congress.
We're dealing with what the historians call counterfactuals. Imagine that the assassin in Los Angeles had missed, and Bobby Kennedy had lived. Would he have got the Democratic nomination rather than Hubert Humphrey? And would he have gone on to beat Richard Nixon?
Great point. It was by no means a locked-up nomination by any means. Could he have beaten Dick Nixon? Would have been a great campaign. I think, Milt, what I find, and caller, from listening to all these tapes, I've concluded while I jam the mic in my face, that history is a series of random collisions and mass hallucinations and almost like a hall of mirrors. And to ask these questions is fascinating, but it doesn't really get us anywhere. And the one, because it's all hypothetical, it's fun to speculate. The one question that bothers me the most is the person we swear in as the next president, I want to fully understand their executive strengths and weaknesses. I'll know about their policies during the campaign, but I want to know how they're going to run that office now rather than later.
You do feel that some, not the ones we were commending before, but I guess most of the others, were sort of wrecked by the office, were overwhelmed by it.
Well, there's no question about that. It And that's a function, I think, of their own ignorance, of their own flaws and weaknesses and mistakes. And I submit to you that when presidents succeed, it's because they are consciously or otherwise compensating for their mistakes and getting as much information as they can and having people tell them they're screwing up or they're about to screw up. And that's the most important skill you can have in that office.
But you see Nixon, Ford, Carter, maybe Bush, probably Clinton, in varying degrees, to have been rather overwhelmed by the job.
But there's a flip side to that, Milt. In a strange way, there's a beautiful part to the presidency that we often forget. Jimmy Carter was run out of town on a rail, basically. He almost had to be carried out of the Oval Office. I talk about that in my book, physically helped out of the office that last day. But when you look at his achievements, they are rather extraordinary. He did very well with Congress, despite the fact that they hated him. He did very well on a number of domestic issues and even international issues, and I go through them. It's a long list. It's extraordinary. He never gets credit for it. Big point, energy crisis. He fixed the energy crisis, but it got fixed 4 years into Reagan's term. Therefore, Jimmy Carter gets no credit for it, but that's the way these cycles work.
Well, a big point that Bob Woodward makes in his book, and we'll be discussing this, as I said, with Bob Woodward on Monday night, is that since Nixon, an atmosphere of scandal and scandal hunting by the press has intimidated all of the succeeding presidents and has affected their presidential performance.
Yes, that happened the second that Alexander Butterfield said there are tapes in the people's presidential office, because that was such a violation of what is really our office, and I think that nothing has been the same since. But presidents ought to know that by now, and I think by now they ought to know that, like Bill Clinton should have known the first time he stepped before the people, he should have said, I made a mistake, it's a private matter, I'm terribly sorry, let's get through this and let's get over it. I would have forgiven him in 10 seconds.
In this conversation tonight, I've been haunted by the thought, by the model really laid out by an old friend of mine, James David Barber, and I know you've read his book, Presidential Character.
Great book.
In that very important work, Barber, who's a political scientist but who had a great deal of psychological sophistication as well, decides to settle for a simple four-fold contingency table, as they say. There are four kinds of presidents, he says. The two dimensions are active versus passive and positive versus negative. Active means active, and passive means just handling problems as they come but not really initiating anything. And positive means I enjoy the work, the Roosevelt characterization we were making earlier. And negative means it's a burden. It's torture. But I've got to go through with it. Clearly, you are agreeing with Barber that our best presidents are active, positive types.
Absolutely. Look at the fun John Kennedy had with his presidency. He never proved greatness or not greatness. He never had time. But Franklin Roosevelt, look at the fun that you have doing this job. I think if you don't do that, you're pretty much dead in whatever job you have. But I think that Bill Clinton has smashed many of the old models of the presidency. He has proven that in the Oval Office, the American people sometimes think that competence is more important than character. We certainly have been able to separate the two. That's never been put to us before, and that is completely confusing and very troubling in my mind for what will happen in the future, although I certainly think the presidents from now are going to be darn sure they don't misbehave in the sanctity of that incredible office.
Yeah. When you look at the people in the field right now, inevitably we end, I suppose, thinking about presidents to come and the contest underway. Is there any, thinking of the broad field, not just the two leading candidates, is there anyone who, at least from a distance, strikes you as having more certainly that active, positive quality of character that you think the job needs?
George W. Bush seems to be very active, positive. He seems to really enjoy life and enjoy his work, and that's a heck of a head start. Elizabeth Dole, I can't figure out. I don't have enough information on her, really. Al Gore remains to be seen. It's hard to think of a better trained man in American history for that office. I don't know if he has what it takes to connect with us emotionally as the great active positives did. I wonder if he is. He might be a passive positive. Great question. And what I want to know from all of these people is what sort of an executive are you?
You haven't mentioned Bill Bradley. You haven't mentioned Forbes.
Great possibilities there. Forbes coming from the corporate world and Bradley being a superb politician. But can Bradley connect with us emotionally? I don't know. I wonder if we need that now in this era. And Milt, what's incredible about
Kosovo is that the American president is now the world's imperial police chief. Think of the new challenges of disorder on the one hand attacking the presidency and 21st century technology from the other. Did you know that today the president can press a button on a global interception network of electronic surveillance and monitor faxes, emails, and phone calls throughout the planet for security purposes? It's called Echelon. It's been written about before. Fascinating system. Think of the horrors of the possible abuse of such a system. I think we need such a system for crime control, but you think of those two phenomena in the Oval Office as a truly frightening place. We really have to know the people we elect much, much better before we elect them.
But how can we get to know them?
We have to ask them the right questions. We have to understand what it's like day to day, to how they operate, what they're like to work for, and how they make decisions, because that's what we elect them to do and not kill us in the process and make our lives better.
Here is a quick email that I should read. It's in response to the question raised by an earlier caller. Great show. Thank you for that, sir. The tape excerpt you spoke of involving Mayor Daley and JFK was included in a two-hour PBS episode of The American Experience. Mayor Daley was the subject of the show, which was broadcast within the last few years. And he says he's got a tape of the show in his video library.
You could go right to the JFK library if you're interested, or any of the presidential libraries, if you're interested in any of these tapes and order them. I suggest you do, because they're pure gold. It's the most thrilling experience an American can have.
Another caller asked, and there isn't time to get to him, is material of this sort available on the Internet? That is, the tapes themselves.
Yes, you can. I actually have a website that is being built now and will be available soon. But bits and pieces of this, for example, are on the C-SPAN website. You can go to the Barnes & Noble website for my book, Inside the Oval Office, and there are a number of clips posted there if you have real audio. And it will be available in a number of other Internet formats in the near future.
The great mystery, or rather the great frustration, with all of the tapes that are accumulated, the single largest batch is simply not available, the Nixon tapes.
Yeah, the Nixon tapes are hung up in complex litigation. I actually testified at the Nixon trial earlier this year, where his estate is saying that we, the taxpayer, owe him, his estate, $200 million in retroactive theoretical compensation for that material's worth.
Goodness.
In 1974. It wasn't too hard for me, as a TV executive, to testify, not really, it was worth zero. That won't be available for a while.
3 or 4 years at the most, though, isn't that right?
I believe it's early in the next century, that's right.
Will everything then be released, or is it doled out in small doses?
Eventually, all those tapes you'll be able to buy and trade and listen to and sell to anyone you want to. They'll be public material.
Well, sir, we come to the end of the available time. Thank you for a most interesting and inevitably, to me, a very enjoyable conversation as well. And time only to remind you that the new book by William Doyle is titled Inside the Oval Office, The White House Tapes from FDR to Clinton, and that's published by Codon Shaw Press. We will not be on the air for the next two nights, baseball coming in from Denver, I believe, but we'll be back Monday night in full form for the full 2 hours. Our guest, the aforementioned Bob Woodward, and we'll go on with our presidential seminar, as it were. Until then, a cordial good night to all.
Chicago News and Talk Radio.